Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
My name is Ali Wayne. I'm an undocumented organizer out of Syracuse, New York. I was originally born in Senegal, and I work with a range of groups, including the Syracuse Peace Council, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, the Undocumented and Black Network, and Black Lives Matter Syracuse, amongst other groups.
So I was just looking at your Facebook page, and you know, everybody is posting the story of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement folks taking somebody out of a hospital who had a brain tumor, and most people are sort of posting this with, that's not normal, this is not normal, I can't believe this is our new normal. And your response was, I see ICE is getting back to its old tactics. So can you talk a little bit about what people who are just realizing what normal has been should know about what normal has been?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think those of us who have been undocumented organizers for years are struggling with sort of two energies right now, right? Like, on the one hand, we are so excited to see so many new folks come into organizing spaces, realize what ICE and Border Patrol, you know, with the cooperation of police, have been doing for so many years, and really want to fight that. However, so much of this stuff was happening, you know, under both Obama and President Bush Jr., and we were not getting the same responses. And the thing that was sort of confusing about President Obama was that his rhetoric on immigration was really great. Like, I literally remember times when I was listening to a speech on immigration and by President Obama and feel like, well, shouldn't he then not ramp up the level of enforcement? But when it came to practice, you know, the Obama administration used to do some of these raids that we're seeing happening. Those things were routine under Obama until maybe the last 2 years of the administration, when they started to really start to ease up on so-called low priority individuals. But that took a lot of time and a lot of organizing. You know, you mentioned this case about someone being taken out of a hospital by ICE or Border Patrol recently, and that's shocking to a lot of folks, but I can think of numerous instances where when that happened here locally, here in the Syracuse area, for example. You know, ICE and Border Patrol have not respected hospitals for years. It might be a shocking thing for folks who are not aware that this has been happening, but this used to be routine, and the only difference is that now Trump has really allowed these organizations to sort of run wild at this point. You know, they've actually, their rhetoric is that they felt restrained under Obama, despite the fact that Obama deported, you know, 2.5 million undocumented folks, more than any other president. But they still have been wanting to do more, and now Trump has basically authorized them to pretty much go after all 11 million undocumented immigrants, because the definition of criminal alien has been so expanded that now pretty much anyone who's undocumented, you know, can be considered a criminal alien. So it's just open season now, unfortunately.
Talk about the Democrats' role specifically in building and or enabling the system that is now being handed over to President Trump.
Sure. The Democrats have kind of been terrible on this issue for a long time. You know, as an organizer, an undocumented organizer, I've always felt that, you know, there are the interests of the Republican Party, there are the interests of the Democratic Party, and then there are the interests of the undocumented community. And these interests are very specifically separate. And there has been a tension within the movement for years around, you know, migrants' rights, you know, folks' work, who, with some folks sort of collaborating a lot more with the Democratic Party in terms of the many compromises in terms of legislation, And those of us who have been at the grassroots for a long time, who have actually been sort of the Cassandras, you know, sort of saying,
yes,
you know, this is very worrying. If we allow for the criminalization of some of our folks, if we say,
right,
if we feed the narrative of the good immigrant versus the criminal alien, eventually someone is going to rise to power who's going to criminalize us all.
Right.
And the reality is that in order to get quote-unquote compromises going in the Democratic Party has really gave ramped up levels of enforcement for many, many years. I'll give you one specific example.
Yeah.
You know, Chuck Schumer right now is sort of painting himself as this champion,
right,
of immigrants, and how could this possibly happen? Well,
yeah,
you know, Chuck Schumer, as part of the Gang of Eight, you know, voted for a border wall that would be so militarized that John McCain actually said that it would put the Berlin Wall to shame. That was the Senate compromise. That was the quote-unquote liberal version of immigration reform. So there's,
yeah,
a hypocrisy in sort of being shocked about, you know, Trump sort of proposing a border wall when the compromise by Republicans and Democrats included, you know, this ramp up of ICE and CBP and a border wall that was deeply, deeply militarized. And I think that's one of the things that we need to pay attention to, especially as we organize, but, you know, somewhat with the Democratic Party, is to, we need to remember that many of these folks have not necessarily been on our side and have compromised our humanity sort of, you know, left and right. I'll give you another specific,
yeah,
example. When President Obama was trying to figure out whether or not he was going to push for DACA, the Deferred,
yeah,
Action for Childhood Arrivals program,
right,
which are basically three-year work permits, right? This was around the time that the Central American refugee so-called crisis was happening. And by then, I was already a jaded organizer. And I remember,
right,
predicting very quickly what the Obama administration, along with other prominent Democrats like Hillary Clinton, would do, is that they would speed up the deportation of many of these refugees. Many of them were,
right,
unaccompanied minors who were kids,
right,
in order to sort of position themselves as being tough on the border, so sacrifice,
right,
these kids to deportation so that they could give themselves some political leverage to push for something like DACA. And, I mean, I hated to be right, but it was clear that that was what's going to happen, that some of us, some of our lives, some of our humanities were going to be sacrificed at the political altar, you know.
Right.
And that's, unfortunately, how the Democratic Party has seen so many of us who are undocumented, as kind of chips, bargaining chips, rather than as full human beings who are fighting for our rights. So, you know, I have a lot more faith in grassroots organizers, including undocumented organizers, than I have in the Democratic Party actually standing up for people like myself and the people that I care for.
Yeah. Yeah, and I want to talk about the intersection with the Black Lives Matter movement, as we were talking about. One of the things in common is that people sort of come late to realizing the daily militarized reality of a lot of people's lives. But, you know, the image that in most people's head of an undocumented person in this country is probably still Latino. And
yep,
obviously that is not the sole experience. So I would love for you to talk about your work on immigration and specifically on, you know, in the different coalitions that you're in,
yep,
on Black people and immigration.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, as folks who are undocumented and Black, we live at that, you know, brutal intersection, right? You know, we're criminalized by ICE and Border Patrol, and we are Black folks, and therefore we are criminalized,
right,
by the system as a whole.
Right.
And which is actually why I think that we can provide a lens and an analysis that the broader sort of immigrant system, immigration rights system, does not sort of take,
yeah,
into account. Like, we are very clear that,
yeah,
fighting the immigration system is part of fighting against the prison industrial complex. And, you know, I actually kind of weirdly, I don't mean to say lucked into the Black Lives Matter movement, but one of my friends who is now the executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration is Opal Tometi, who is one of the three women who co-founded Black Lives Matter. And a lot of folks don't know that her parents were undocumented as she was growing up. A lot of folks don't know that she started out organizing, doing work at the border. We're very clear and intentional about sort of making the connections here. Like, I remember at one of the early Black Alliance for Just Immigration conferences, I spoke with Unisela, who used to go by Phil Agnew. And, you know, we were having very intentional conversations around sort of how the same prison companies that, you know, made a mint out of the incarceration of poor black and brown U.S. citizens under the rubric of the so-called war on drugs are the very same prison corporations, you know, that as soon as the war on terror sort of kick-started, you know, saw immigrants as the new cash cow, and that we couldn't afford not to organize, you know, in concert. But this is why I think in many ways, you know, the immigration conversation is a racial justice conversation.
Right.
Like you mentioned that when folks still think about undocumented folks, they think about Latinos, which has actually been this weird, like, I don't want to say privilege that I've had, but like I've had U.S. citizen Latino friends stopped by Border Patrol and ICE. And, you know, I've been able to sort of get away with it because I don't look Latino. Of course, I'm black, and therefore I'm always getting stopped by cops anyway, right? But I think that, you know, it would be a lie to have an analysis of the immigration system that doesn't speak very directly about the influence of race in this country. And I'll give you another quick example, which is that I don't find it to be a coincidence that Arizona, which is the state that really was sort of the laboratory for some of the worst anti-immigrant pieces of legislation to come out, is also the state where the state legislature was the most adamant about questioning the citizenship of Barack Obama.
Right.
You know, I think there's a connection there. Like, what does it say that you can become the first black president and still there's a whole swath of people who are asking basic questions about whether or not you truly are American? What that means is that citizenship is still very much connected to the idea of whiteness. So I think there's a deep connection there. And, of course, the thing that makes it even more painful when you think about it is that, you know, we've had the first black president who's now deported, you know, more undocumented folks than any other president. And that says something about, you know, what power does to you within the system. So,
for sure. And, you know, related to all of this, and the thing we've been circling around is this question of this criminal versus good immigrant narrative. And one of the things that we've seen even in the last couple of weeks with the days without an immigrant and the small business closures and things like that is a real resurgence of this, like, but we're good immigrants, we're not criminals. At the same time as Donald Trump is like posting a list of, you know, crimes committed by immigrants on his website or whatever. And so, you know, the work that many, many people have done to challenge that narrative over the last several years is just like, it seems like it's starting over again. Right.
Yeah.
But it's how do you challenge the narrative of this, you know, this Trump, you know, crimes committed by immigrants narrative, without falling into this, like, most immigrants aren't criminals, though, and we're the good ones language?
Well, I mean, that's the thing that's the problem, is a lot of the more mainstream immigration reform organizations have been using this narrative for a long time. And those of us who have been rejecting this narrative, we don't have the political access precisely because we've rejected that narrative. You know, like, I'll give you, you know, I mean, for me, when I fight for my status, the way that I see it is that I'm fighting for the rights that I'm already owed as a human being. I'm not seeing it as sort of like a favor that this system sort of confers on me. But I think that at a time of fear and at a time of economic desperation, that's unfortunately when people turn to immigrants as scapegoats. That's when all the old narratives come back around, seeing immigrants not just as people who are full human beings who deserve rights, but only, like, we're seeing a lot of messaging coming out of the mainstream organizations around, you know, undocumented immigrants pay taxes, undocumented immigrants are worth this much in terms of the economy. So you're seeing this language around how immigrants are only worthy because of the economic labor that they're providing, as opposed to being people who deserve to have human rights. And so that's part of the broader narrative, the broader conversation that needs to happen. You know, as an undocumented organizer, like, I've, for many, many years, I've been trying to make the argument that poor U.S. citizens have a lot more in common with undocumented workers than they think in terms of the ways in which this sort of neoliberal economic system has hurt all of us. You know, I mean, you didn't get this huge influx of Mexican immigrants, you know, in the 90s without NAFTA, you know, being passed. And that's a much more complicated thing to lay out. And that's a conversation that most folks in the Democratic Party are not willing to have, and they're not willing to acknowledge that because they're so embedded in the system. And so, you know, it has to do with radicalizing undocumented organizers and radicalizing allies as well. You know, like, right now, one of the fears in a lot of these sanctuary efforts is that most of the folks who want to engage in this sanctuary effort are folks who want to come in and say, you know, we're only here to protect folks, you know, with no criminal records. I think that most folks who are coming into these organizing spaces are very new, very green, and I think that in their mind, they're coming to these spaces to make sure to protect undocumented workers, quote-unquote, without criminal records, not understanding, you know, sort of how widely expanded the definition of criminal alien has been, which is why it's so important to have these sanctuary efforts, you know, include clauses around protecting everyone, including folks who are considered felons. But that's very, very important because, frankly, it is ridiculously easy to become a quote-unquote felon under immigration law. And that includes not just undocumented folks, but legal permanent residents as well. So that's, you know, that's one of the things that I'm a little bit worried about a lot of these sanctuary efforts is I wonder if they are actually going to be able to protect individuals because it's so easy to find an excuse, you know, to deport pretty much anyone. And I mean, it's heartbreaking to see, but, like, I think that the level of viciousness of the deportations that we are seeing, like, might slowly start educating folks about this system. But we are dealing not just with we're dealing with deep ideologies around these different systems. You know, I think that most folks think of the criminal justice system and the immigration system as being inherently just and don't understand that these systems, you know, are systems of criminalization. And that is that's a lot of the education work that we're going to have to do in the next couple of years. I hope that our allies step up to the plate and really educate themselves on these issues. But I don't know. I don't know what the outcome is going to be.
Yeah. And, of course, the idea of sanctuary city doesn't protect you when ICE just comes in by themselves and does a raid or stops people on a street corner or walks into a domestic violence shelter.
Yeah, I mean, sanctuary efforts have to include physical housing, frankly, and not just housing in faith communities, but housing in, you know, individual homes of folks who are willing to harbor an undocumented person if worse came to worse. Because that's where we're at. You know, all of these sanctuary efforts, like you mentioned, they're nice, but if ICE and CBP show up, you know, they're just going to pick people up. So sanctuary has to do with more than just legislation, and it's actually been sort of a pet peeve frustration of mine to see, you know, a lot of folks come out and say, you know, yeah, we're a sanctuary city, we're a sanctuary community. but without enough solid clauses in those pieces of legislation to stop actual CBP and ICE from deporting individuals. So, yeah, I mean, it's nice to see the rhetoric, and I think, sadly, we're at a place where, you know, for any Democrats to declare that they're still going to be sort of a leader in the sanctuary city, sanctuary place, that's seen as quote-unquote political courage in this era, which is a depressingly low standard.
Yeah.
But we need more than just, you know, a couple of pronouncements. We're going to need solid allies who are going to be willing to challenge the federal government.
And there are so many things that I think people are just trying to figure out. Like, there's another round of these, like, cut and paste, ICE is doing a raid at this place.
Right.
And without any documentation, without anything, sort of the way that people react to things and the way that people sort of see social media as the place where they do things, specifically around that and around, like, what should people do in that moment if they hear that there's a raid, if they hear that there are, you know, like, what can people who aren't at risk of deportation do to help people in that moment?
Yeah. I mean, what they need to do is double and triple check their sources, do the work. You know, I've definitely been impacted by some of this kind of, you know, copy posting of these things. You know, first of all, folks need to understand, like, those of us who are undocumented are already in enough of a panic, okay? Like, we are already struggling to sort of keep our heads together.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a report here in upstate New York about potential raids in Geneva, and me and another local friend of ours, we spent, like, 24 hours, like, figuring out, like, whether or not it was happening, and after the 24 hours, we found out this was a fake report, you know?
Yeah.
And so we wasted 24 hours of organizing on like a fake report, and people need to understand that if they do want to be allies, if they do want to help, the best thing is to make sure that the source is absolutely accurate, and that might require, you know, reaching out to local activists, local organizers, doing your own work, not simply, you know, sharing on Facebook, because that makes our work as organizers harder, because then we aren't as effective in our responses, because we're, you know, we're going like 5-6 different directions. And right now is a very, very tense time in the community. So, you know, I definitely hear the desire and the desire to sort of be, to tell people, to warn people, to keep people safe. But the way that you keep people safe is not by simply sharing hearsay, but, like, if you do find out about something and it could be a real thing, do as much work as possible to make sure that it is, you know, something actually happening before you post it. Because if it's not real, then it, you know, it creates unnecessary panic, number one, and it hobbles the efforts of organizers on the ground.
And also, it's funny because everybody wants to sort of laugh at the post-fact Trump administration.
Yeah.
then people's first reaction to anything is to sort of fly into a panic and cut and paste anything that is totally unsourced. Like, facts matter for a lot of real reasons, guys.
Yep.
Not just so you don't get made fun of on The Daily Show.
And I think it's, you know, I understand that, but I almost see it as a strategy of the Trump administration, right? Like, they're throwing so much at us all at once.
Yeah.
That it's like, if we're panicking and we're uncoordinated and we're unfocused, we might not be able to respond as effectively. And I think if we are going to be able to mass a serious resistance to this administration, we're going to need to be very, very focused, very intentional, very deliberate in our response. We cannot cede to the panic and to the fear. I mean, we can be fearful, right? Like, I'm afraid all of the time, but at the same time, we can't organize out of fear. You know, we have to organize smartly, effectively, in a way that is sustainable, so that, you know, we don't burn out within, like, the first 2 months of this administration. Like, we need to be able to mass a resistance effort that's going to last for as long as, you know, as this is continuing.
Yeah. I don't even want to think about how long it's going to continue. But that it really is this thing where like the people that I sort of see posting about panic the most are the people who are the least connected to political organizing.
Right.
And the people who have been doing the work are the ones who are posting less things about being terrified and, oh my God, what do we do? And this is not normal. And are more like, this is what we're doing. This is what you can do. This is what we have done. And yes, sometimes I'm tired and I'm scared and I'm burnt out, but there are things that can be done.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. And for those of us who have been doing this work for a long time, we also need to find that balance. You know, I've been in a lot of organizing spaces these past couple of days or months, you know, ever since Trump was elected, when, you know, some really new person in organizing just takes up a lot of space and just sort of like dumps whatever is happening emotionally and says all sorts of problematic things and sort of sucks in the energy. And there's a piece of me that just simply wants to tell that person, like, you know, you're wasting our time. You know, we don't have the time to do therapy right now. However,
yeah.
At the same time, there's a piece of me that also wants to keep these folks in and
yeah.
connected and help them grow as organizers. Because frankly, I was the same way. Like the first year that I did organizing on immigration, I
yeah.
was terrible. And that was
yeah.
because I was organizing out of sheer trauma, you know. So
yeah.
whenever someone would say something like terrible about quote-unquote an illegal or something like that, I'd go like right back at them and like scream and like call them names and everything. And it would feel
yeah.
real good, but it would not help the organizing. It would not bring in more folks, you know. Like, that's where, you know, and I'm very intentional, like part of my survival mechanism has been mental health counseling so that, you know, I have a space where I can download all of that stuff. But in an organizing space, it can't simply be about me, because if it is simply about me, then I'm not going to organize effectively. And so I guess those of us who have been doing this for a while are going to need to find that balance between, you know, not having these spaces evolve into simply sort of, you know, therapy spaces, but at the
yeah.
same time being patient enough to remember, like, you know, well, you know, you kind of used to be the same way as well. And
yeah.
so,
yeah.
so it's, I think it's going to be a challenge to a lot of us, but that's the work.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about self-care, but I think one of the things that we, you know, that to talk about how you have to take care of yourself ends up falling back on a lot of these neoliberal individualist narratives anyway. And so it is this question of, like, how do we take care of each other? And when we're thinking about what sanctuary, what being a sanctuary city, a sanctuary town looks like, it's these are still questions of how we take care of each other.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see self-care is, maybe it's because of the African in me, but, like, there's a old proverb from Kenya that I really loved, and it says, I am only well if you are well. So,
yeah.
you know, the idea is that your health is connected to the health of the community, you know. And
yeah.
I think that I do think it's important for all of us to take care of ourselves, to take some time off as a part of the work. And I'm very much influenced by, you know, folks like Audre Lorde, for example, who think of, like, healing as a political right, you know, healing justice, you know, that we're not just here to burn out constantly. You know, like, I, as someone who has burned out 3 times in the past, like,
yeah.
I've learned to respect the limitations of my body and spirit. And I've learned that when I am close to burnout, I'm not effective. I don't so much think of self-care as an individual right, as number one, a political right, but number two, something that is an energy that is kind of communal, you know, like I take care of myself, but I also make sure that you're taken care of, and that there's a sort of circle that kind of happens, you know, like you have, I'm not only simply sort of healthy because I'm feeling good about myself, you know, like I'm healthier
yeah.
when you're doing better and vice versa. So that's kind of the way that I see this sort of self-care conversation. And we're going to need to develop those muscles over the next however long, because this is brutal and it's not going to stop anytime soon.
Yeah. Okay. Unless there's anything else that you want people to know about that you think we should talk about?
No, you know, just fight. I mean, that's what I've been telling folks all the time, and it's okay to be afraid. It's okay to feel a little bit overwhelmed, but do your part. You know, it's like we have all these memes around, sort of, kind of like, you know, what would you have done in this fascist mm-hmm. time or whatever. Well, I don't mean to exaggerate, but I really feel like we're close to one of those times. Like, this is the time when people need to step up, because we don't have the luxury of political paralysis. I'm not saying, like, burnout. I'm not saying, like, you know, do everything all of the time. But I'm saying do something, because I really feel like the soul of this country is being tested right now, and that the American experiment is being tested, and we shall see what the results are. If I were a betting man, I wouldn't know which side is going to win. But I sure know that I'm going to fight, and I certainly hope that other folks are going to keep fighting, because this is too important.
Yeah. How can people keep up with you and the organizations that you work with?
Yeah, all of the groups that I mentioned, I believe, have websites. One is the Syracuse Peace Council. The other is the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. Another one is the Undocumented and Black Network. If you just Google all three of those, you should be able to connect with these groups. And I'm pretty much constantly on Facebook, so if folks, you know, need to reach out to me, they can reach out to me on that platform.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.